All right, this is study number 3 on Samuel Rutherford's Lex Rex. We saw last time in question 4 that the people as a body, which Rutherford also calls states, groups, were vital to the process of granting authority to a particular man to become king. And Rutherford said that although God extraordinarily designed some men to be kings and anointed them by the prophets, yet were they never actually installed kings till the people made them kings. So he's got this close relationship. He does not remove God from the picture. God is behind it all. God is the sovereign first cause and mover of all things. But he refuses to allow, particularly the guys objecting in his day, refuses to allow them to remove everything away from people, that they don't have a say in what who becomes king. The office of king is immediately from God, Rutherford says, but that which specifically applies to this office and royal power to a particular man, but the way it specifically applies this to a particular man is God inclining the hearts of the people or states to choose this man and not that man. So that's how we get to the actual person. In question number 5, Rutherford deals with more objections raised by his opponent who claimed that the king in no way was made by the people. They had no hand in his calling and in his authority to rule. And Rutherford repeats his arguments that we no longer have prophets, and so the way God indicates who is to be king is by the people's act of constituting the man king. For it is by mediation of this act of the people that royal authority is conveyed to the man. He says, how do we know? If we have no Samuel out there telling us this is the king, how do we know who's king? Suddenly somebody just rises up and takes over with force or whatever. Is that the king? How do we know what's going on? He says, no, it has to be the people that show us. Rutherford says that in the people choosing one person above another to be their king shows that the king is less and dependent upon the people. He's less than them and he's dependent. Rutherford says, seeing God intended the king for the people's good and not the people for the king's good. He says it shows that. The king is intended for the people's good, not the reverse. Rutherford also said that the people must make a king following the rule of God's word. And then he quotes a couple of verses, one of them being Deuteronomy 17, 14 through 20, where it says, when you come to the land which the Lord your God is giving you, and possess it and dwell in it, and say, I will set a king over me like the other nations that are around me, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your brethren, okay, so it's not anybody here. One from among your brethren you shall set over you as king. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother, but he shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. For the Lord has said to you, you shall not return that way again. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. Also it shall be, when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book, from the one before the priests, the Levites, and it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, and be careful to observe all the words of the law and the statutes, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brethren, that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, and that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children, in the midst of Israel. Those are the kind of leaders you are to choose. There's qualifications and characteristics of the kind of leaders, and we should not choose outside that. And Rutherford is saying this is applicable today. This is not something that was for Israel. This is something that is in binding, perpetual expectation from God for people to choose the character of their king. In Deuteronomy 1, this is another verse Rutherford quotes when he talks about choose a king according to the Lord's ways, Deuteronomy 1, 16 through 18. He says, then I commanded your judges at that time, saying, hear the cases between your brethren and judge righteously between a man and his brother or the stranger who is with him. You shall not show partiality in judgment. You shall not hear the small as you shall hear the small as well as the great. You shall not be afraid in any man's presence, for the judgment is God's. The case that is too hard for you, bring to me. This is Moses speaking, and I will hear it. And I commanded you at that time all the things which you should do. And then the last one that Rutherford quotes, 2 Chronicles 19, 6 and 7. There's a word to the judges, and the word says, take heed to what you are doing, for you do not judge for man, but for the Lord, who is with you in the judgment. Now therefore, let the fear of the Lord be upon you. Take care and do it, for there is no iniquity with the Lord our God, no partiality, no taking of bribes. Okay, so here we've got a comprehensive, imagine if we could just apply those principles, those 16 lines, or however many it comes up, to our qualification. That's all you'd have to do. You wouldn't need a $1 billion campaign. Just one web page. This is what I stand for. You wouldn't get any votes, but, well, you get a few, but that would be an incredible basis for. So then in question six, it continues along the same lines, and Rutherford says that if people in no way make a king, because all authority is immediately from God, this is his opponent, his argument. People in no way make a king, because God immediately makes kings without any help of anybody else. There's no contribution anywhere. He says, if this is the case, it is no more lawful to resist aristocratical government and our lords of parliament or judges than it is lawful to resist the king. He says, if that's the case, if authority on that level comes immediately from God, then it applies to every area of authority, and you cannot resist any area of authority. There never can be resistance to even the lesser magistrates, the parliament or the judges or anything, because they are from God, and who are you to question God? So this is, he wants his opponent to be consistent. In this, on the next page, he says, by this false reasoning of his opponent, it would mean that inferior judges are no less immediate deputies from God, and so irresistible as kings are. And so then Rutherford supports his argument by quoting from Numbers 11:16, where Moses was struggling, if you remember, with the burden of leadership, and God then set in place the setting up of some people who would help him, the 70 elders who would help him. And these governments, although they were inferior to Moses, because they would bring problems to him, he was the ultimate one that who got this chain if they had a problem. But although they were inferior to him, the scriptures tell us that the same spirit that was on Moses, the Lord took and put on these men. And so if Moses is irresistible because he was immediately appointed by God, then so were these men, immediately appointed by God, and therefore irresistible, and so therefore nothing could be, no fault could be found with them. So Rutherford then added on page 19, the judges are to kiss Christ, Psalm 2:12. That's the responsibility. Judges and rulers, that's what they're supposed to do. And in quoting that psalm, it shows that Rutherford has no mystical understanding of government and rule. He understands how Psalm 2 applied to modern political leaders. There was nothing mystical about his view, and it shows that he expected judges and rulers and kings and lesser magistrates to bow to Christ, and that Christ's law was the only standard that was acceptable. And if you default at that point, the whole thing unravels, as far as from a Christian perspective. If it is not the law of God, if the law of God is not comprehensive, if it is not authoritative to deal with the dusty details of life, what do we have? Where do we turn? And so the whole thing begins to unravel. In question 7, he has to do with another pile of arguments aimed at Rutherford's opponent to prove that the people are wholly excluded. That's his opponent keeps bringing this out, from having any hand in making the king. And I'll only touch on some things that add to what we've already seen. Moreover, we need to go into we have no need to go into all the discussions that are more relevant to those times. There were some issues that Rutherford had to deal with that were just very pertinent to his times. And while you could learn maybe some things from application, I don't think it's helpful at this stage. So on page 24, Rutherford denied that those who come to the crown by conquest and blood are essentially kings. They're not. He denied that, as his opponent claimed. So one king conquering another nation, he's saying it doesn't grant them the right to be king. So we can discuss it. He comes back to that, and we can look at it in more detail at another time or later on tonight. Rutherford said, just as the king obtained his power mediately, kind of through the people, he also loses his power mediately. He loses it through the people. So he gets it through them and he loses it through them. Obviously, God is always supreme, ultimate behind it all. And he says, I quote Rutherford, when God is to cast off kings, he causes them to lose all authority and makes them come into contempt with the people. God does not take the authority of the king from him immediately, but mediately, by the people hating and despising him when they see his wickedness. Upon this, all the people condemn him and despise him, and so the majesty is taken from him when they see him trample upon all laws, divine and human, and that mediately by the people's heart despising of his majesty, and so they take it again. That's the people, that awesome authority that they once gave him, and this proveth that God gave him the authority mediately by the consent of man. So once they lose heart in him, they take back that power because they had given it to him and they have the right to retrieve it. Which obviously, Rutherford's opponent, this was absolute anathema to say that the people could remove the king's power. And the reason he argued that, the reason he argued so strongly that the people had nothing to do with the king's power was so that he could defend the right of the absolute sovereignty of the king to do exactly what he wanted and be under no law. So Rutherford said, citizens naturally fear their supreme governor of the city, yet they give to the man who is their supreme governor that power and authority which is the ground of awe and reverence. Why do we fear the king? Because we have given him power to deal with us. We've given him the laws to deal with us, and these are powerful laws, and we reverence and we awe those laws because of the power we have given him to deal with us and our society. He ends off that section by saying, power of life and death is not given to the king only, but also to other magistrates, yea, and to a single private man in the just defense of his own life. Okay, so in the defense of his own life, he has that power, the just defense of his own life. In question 8, Rutherford was responding to his opponent's argument that the people are not capable of any power of government. They have no government in themselves. That was the argument. So Rutherford says, but the question is not of the power of governing in the people. Do they have a power of governing? He says, no. The question is about the power of government, that is, of the power of making governors and kings. Do we have power, and do the people have power in themselves to make governors and kings? Rutherford says they have this in them. His opponent says no. He says, and the community doth put forth in act this power as a free, voluntary, and active power. For a community transplanted to any place, if a community was transplanted to any place in the world not before inhabited, and have perfect liberty to choose either a monarchy or a democracy or an aristocracy, for though nature incline them to government, in general, they are not naturally determined to any one of these three more than the other. Okay, so what he's saying, he uses the word nature or naturally. Nature determines and pushes us to government. We'll come back to this in a bit. Nature forces us. We need government. We need authority. We need structure. We need people to rule us and to bring sanctions and discipline upon us. So while we need that, and therefore this forces us to establish governments, naturally we do not have to pick any one particular form of government. So basically, Rutherford's position, you might disagree with that, you can wrestle with it in your own mind. Rutherford's position was, whether it's a monarchy, whether it's a democracy, whether it's an aristocracy, it doesn't really matter. They're all going to be governed by the same law, God's law. They're all accountable to serve the people. And so whatever form you decide you want to set up, you're not in violation of God's truth, but you're going to have government. That's easy. You can wrestle with that. So he concludes question 8 by saying, the people are worthier and more excellent than the king, and they have an active power of ruling and directing themselves toward the intrinsical end of human policy. Okay, the intrinsical end, the ultimate. This is the goal. This is the core. Human policy, this is the core of human policy. And they have a right to direct themselves towards this intrinsical end of human policy. And this is the intrinsical end, which is the external safety and peace of a society. That's the purpose of government. In a nutshell, that's rather the external peace and safety of society. We're going to have society. We cannot escape society. We can't all have our own little island where we're autonomous as a family on an island. We're going to live together as families, and we're going to have to function together. We're going to have rules of, hey, what belongs to what, and what can you do and can't you do? And so that is the intrinsic direction towards which the king's goal and purpose is directed. And he says, so the intrinsic goal of human policy, which is the external safety and peace of a society, insofar as there are moral principles of the second table of Ten Commandments, for this effect, written in their heart. It's there in the heart. That's the only law Rutherford's talking about. There's nothing else that's going to govern them. It's the law of God written on their heart. Therefore, that royal authority which, by God's special providence, is united in one king. Okay, so he's talking about a king now. You could put it however you want. You put it in parliament, whatever. So while all that is united in one king, it is diffused in the people, for the people hath an after appropriative, an approving consent in making a king. It's concentrated in the king, but its source comes from the people, and it's put in the king. What's put in the king? A law to rule. What law? The law that's written on the people's hearts, the law of God. There's no escaping from that. Rutherford was a theonomist. It's impossible to read him any other way. You have to denounce him if you're going to accept him. You're going to have to denounce his theonomy if you're going to say I regard him as a scholar. I regard him as a good writer. Question 9, the question is this: whether or no sovereignty is from the people, that it remaineth in them in some part, so as they may, in case of necessity, resume it. Is the authority from them, so in some crisis comes along that they've given to the leaders, they can take it back. So first of all, Rutherford says, and this is an important part, Rutherford says, there is no private person may kill the king even if he has become tyrannical in his government. It's very important to understand that. No private person can kill the king. He'll later on draw a difference between resistance and killing the king. Those are two different things: overthrowing the kingdom and resisting bad laws. But at this point he's making it very clear that you understand that this is important. No private person can do that. And this is because, Rutherford argues, the first and ultimate and negative subject of all power is the community, as reasonable men naturally inclining to a society. Okay, so it's the community as we are forced into community. But the ethical and political subject, or the legal and positive receptacle of this power, is various according to the various constitutions of that policy. Okay, so, you know, it's going to be manifested in different ways. And the truth is, the community, orderly convened as it includeth all the states, all the estates, civil, have a hand in, and are to act in choosing their rulers. They all have a hand in it. All this makeup of civil society has a hand in making their rulers. But the question now is, if all power of governing be so in the people that they retain power to guard themselves against tyranny, and if they retain some of it, inhabit, and their power, if they retain this in their power, and Rutherford says, yes, they do. Yes, they do retain this. And he affirms this by saying, I lay down the maxim of divinity. This is a summary of the truth. Tyranny being a work of Satan is not from God, because sin, either habitual or actual, is not from God. The power that is must be from God. The magistrate as magistrate is good in nature of office, and the intrinsic end of his office, Romans 13:4, for he is the minister of God for thy good. And therefore a power, ethical, political, or moral, to oppress is not from God, and is not a power, but a licentious deviation of a power. And so is no more from God, but from sinful nature and the old serpent. If for nature to defend itself be lawful, so if naturally the natural law says you can defend yourself, that's lawful to defend your life. No community without sin, so no community without sinning, that's what he's saying, hath power to alienate and give away this power to defend themselves. No community can do that, so no, we're not going to defend ourselves. For as no power given to man to murder his brother is of God, so no power to suffer his brother to be murdered is of God. And no power to allow himself a fortiori, far less, can be from God. Okay, I don't know if you got that. He's saying we cannot allow our brother to be murdered. That's not a power from God by the supreme power. We cannot allow our neighbor, so he says, no power given to man to murder his brother, no power to suffer his brother to be murdered is from God, and no power to suffer himself, allow himself to be killed, be murdered, is from God. No power can demand that. And so basically he's saying any power that is exercising in that tyrannical way to murder is not from God. So he's lifting that to a level of saying, okay, so is that a legitimate authority? Because he's just quoted Romans 13, remember, he's talking about this is what the government has done, and Romans 13 also says he who resists the ordained power is resisting God. And so when the king says we're going to murder these people, is there legitimate power? So Rutherford agrees with Buchanan, who said, and I quote, acts of parliament are not laws obliging the people till they be promulgated, that means made known and implemented, and the people's silence when they are promulgated is their approbation. If the laws are implemented and the people remain silent, the people have consented that those are good laws and they place themselves under those laws. But if the people speak against unjust laws, they are not laws at all. And once again, what are unjust laws? The law of God. That's what it comes back to. Rutherford continues saying, as the power to make just laws is all in the parliament, only the people have power to resist tyrannical laws. The power of all parliament was never given to the king by God. The parliament are essentially judges as the king, and therefore the king's deed may well be revoked, because he acteth nothing as king. He doesn't act like a king, his power can be revoked. But he's still talking here in the community that is revoking, that is carrying out a removal of the king from the office. For Rutherford, just laws were irrevocable. However, he says, we allow no arbitrary power to Parliament because their just laws are irrevocable. He says, any just law is irrevocable, and Parliament should make irrevocable just laws. And we're not giving them an arbitrary power because we're saying their laws are irrevocable. We're saying they are irrevocable because they are based on law. They're in compliance with God's law, and therefore they're irrevocable. How could we revoke them if they're based on God's law? And so there's the authority and the commitment to Parliament. So it's not arbitrary power. And he says, it's not this arbitrary power in people or in mortal man, but of the covenant betwixt king and people hereafter. So he's immediately pulling us into the covenantal relationship between the people and the king who's in power. And that covenant is based upon God's law and in subjection to God's law. I quote again. The king receiveth royal power with the states to make good laws, and power by his royalty to execute those laws. And this power the community hath devolved in the hands of the king and states of parliament. But the community keepeth to themselves a power to resist tyranny and to coerce it, so that David is not to compare, it means to appear, to come before Saul, King Saul, nor to lay down Goliath's sword, nor disband his army of defense, though the king should command him to do so. Okay, so here King Saul wanted to take David's life, and so he's saying, well, David's not resisting a royal law at that point. He's not in violation of Romans 13, which I hope you understand what I mean. Because there was not a different standard in the Old Testament than until Paul wrote Romans 13. People didn't say, well, we're not sure, you know, does the king have authority from God or not? They weren't speculating about that. Paul just confirmed what was already very implicit and clear in the Old Testament. Brotherhood points to both sides when he says the magistrate is to judge by a known statute and law. Any doubts about what that law might be? Good. The community's law is the law of nature. Remember in the first lecture we did, we saw how Rutherford understood the law of nature. That's God's law. It's the law he's talking about written on the hearts of man. It's the law that we see all around us. That is God's imprint upon his creation. And so man's law is the law of nature, not their arbitrary lust. So we can't just say, because these people decided we want a king to do such and such for us, so that's a legitimate law. That's coming from the extreme on the man side, on the people side. And nor can the king do the same thing by making an arbitrary law. When there is a problem, Rutherford says, we teach, this is a quote, we teach not that people should supply all defects in government. I think what he means by supply there is that we have to immediately remedy all defects. Nor that they should use their power when anything is done amiss by the king. Okay, so the power, he's talking the power of what? The power to remove the authority that you gave to the king. So he's saying that's not what it is. He says the people ought to suffer much before they resume their power. Before you overthrow the king, you suffer much. There's much appealing and there's much supplication. Rutherford then says, our law of Scotland will warrant any subject, if the king take from him his heritage or invade his possession against law, to resist the invader and to summon the king's intruders before the lords of session for the act of injustice. Is this against God's word or conscience? No, it's not. If the Scottish king is acting unjustly against your life and your property, you can resist him, and then you can charge him according to the law before the lesser magistrates. He says the command of a king cannot legitimate murder. Legitimize would be the way we might write it here. Should we have government? Rutherford's answer: no society hath liberty to be without all government, for God hath given to every society, and he's quoting from Covarruvius, he's quoting from this guy, but he's agreeing with this quote. He's saying God has given to every society a faculty of preserving themselves and warding off violence and injuries, and this they could not do except they gave their power to one or many rulers. And Rutherford then puts it in his own words, and he says, we teach that government is natural. Natural meaning imbibed in God's creation, inescapable. It's an inescapable principle of life. We cannot escape from it. So it's natural. Government is natural, not voluntary. We don't decide we're going to or we're not going to have government. But the way and manner of government is voluntary, he says. And what is he meaning there? The actual specifics of what that government is going to look like. Democracy. Whatever. And so Rutherford sums up. Indeed, God made the office and royalty of a king above the dignity of the people. But he, by the intervention, the intervening consent of the people, maketh David a king, not Eliab. And the people maketh a covenant at David's inauguration, that David shall have so much power, to wit, power to be a father, not power to be a tyrant, power to fight for the people, not power to waste and destroy them. That's what they're giving him. They're giving him so much to do these things. Now when he says father, He's not getting into socialism, he's not getting into that. He qualifies in other places, you can see he means that's the benevolence, the looking after, the caring, the protecting. That's what he means by that. Question 10 has nothing. It's talking about the perpetual inheriting a king, passing it on as that of authority, and that's kind of more pertinent to his day. You can read that up in your own time if you want to. And then as we end off question 11, I just have a few lines here. And Rutherford talks about giving the king absolute power, which is obviously wrong, but he says that the people can make a king supreme, that is absolute, and so resign nature's birthright, that's their birthright, that is a power to defend themselves, is not lawful. It's unlawful for you to do that, to give the king so much power. For if the people have absolute power to destroy themselves, For if the people have not absolute power to destroy themselves, you can't kill yourself, you can't murder yourself, they cannot resign such a power to their prince. You can't commit suicide and you can't give that authority to the king to kill you unlawfully. We can't unlawfully take our own life. He then argues that it is false that a community, before they be established with formal rulers, have no politic power. So his language is old-fashioned. For consider them as men only and not as associated. They have indeed no political power. Okay, as an individual with no relationship to anybody else, you have no power. But before magistrates be established, they may convene and associate themselves in a body and appoint magistrates, and this they cannot do if they have no politic power at all. And he uses that argument for the authority of the church as well. It's given by the people. But that's it. We'll stop there. We'll pick up at question 12 next time. And he's laying some important foundations in this. And are there any questions or comments you'd like to make? We haven't covered everything we're going to cover, and he's going to clarify. So it's kind of, maybe it's a bit awkward to ask questions, right?